Thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this for such a long time, both in terms of teaching this course and really just coming to Holden Village. I have been hearing about Holden Village for so many years. I went to St. Olaf College myself, and I had so many friends there who spent time here and had their lives transformed by it. And somehow I just never had the chance to make it here until now. I think I probably would have liked to come a few years ago, and then, of course, mine remediation was happening. So I am just so excited to be here, and I'm really glad that Kyan could be here with me. And I'd like to thank Sharon for all of her help, and Peggy and Chuck for inviting me to lead this class. So we're going to do this class on biblical reading. We probably won't use Bibles today, but we probably will later in the week. So feel free to bring those in on your way in. I would also say I have sort of set up the class as a continuous narrative, so it will kind of build on, each class will build on the last. However, it is totally okay if you want to skip a class and then come back, or invite friends who haven't been here. You can drop in or drop out at any moment. So the other thing I will just say is please don't hesitate to interrupt me with a comment or a question. I'll definitely build in time for discussion in many of these classes, but don't be shy about interrupting me. That'll make me happy, not irritated. So just a little bit about me. As Sharon said, I teach at Texas Lutheran University, which is in Seguin, Texas. It is a ELCA college. We have about 1,400 students. It's not far from San Antonio. That's where Kyan and I live, also not too far from Austin. As far as I know, it's the only ELCA college that is officially a Hispanic-serving institution. And starting last year, and even more this coming year, the majority of our students are non-white, which gives us a sort of different feel than other ELCA colleges that I'm familiar with. So I teach theology there. I teach historical and constructive theology. The book on the left is the one I've written. I am a Kierkegaard scholar. I know a lot about Kierkegaard, although I'm not going to be talking about him this week. You can hit me up about that during coffee hour if you're interested. I also did want to give a plug for this book, Radical Lutherans, Lutheran Radicals. I wonder if some of you have seen that or heard of that before. There are a lot of references to Holden in it. Jason Mann, who's the editor, the last chapter is on vocation, and he begins his chapter by talking about Holden Village. So it might be worth looking at. There's a chapter on Luther, there's a chapter on Kierkegaard, there's a chapter on Bonhoeffer, and then a chapter on Dorothy Zola. And it's very much written either for undergraduates or for sort of interested adults. It's meant to be accessible. It's not meant to be super academic. I wrote the chapter on Kierkegaard, and yeah, I know a number of congregations have used it for adult ed, and I think, I mean, it's a good resource for that purpose. So this class, Sharon told me that the theme for education this summer was Reformation. I must say that having been responsible for a lot of the 500th anniversary events at TLU, when I first saw that, my heart sort of sank. Like, I am so done talking about the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. However, what I really decided for this class is we're certainly going to be talking about ways in which Martin Luther changed approaches to biblical readings, and we're going to talk about a number of things that were really good about that. But we're also going to talk about things that were left behind, or you could say disadvantages of the Reformation, or maybe doors that were closed in terms of biblical reading because of the Reformation that might be worth reopening today. So that's going to be our focus throughout the week. Here are some questions that, I won't just read these, but questions that are going to guide us. What exactly are we doing when we read the Bible? How should we think of exactly what the Bible is, right? I mean, most of us realize it wasn't written by one person, right? It was written by many different authors over thousands of years. What do we make of this very diverse and varied archive of books that we have together? What's the purpose of reading it? One question that I'm really interested in is, should we think of it primarily as a source for theological writing or Christian living? Or should we think of it more as a model that people who write or make art as Christians or live as Christians should imitate rather than just sort of extract things from? And then we'll talk about some ancient and medieval interpreters of the Bible. Those were the two books that Sharon held up, one by Gregory of Nyssa, one by Augustine. We'll just read some very brief excerpts from those. There won't be long assignments or anything, don't worry. And then how does this process of reading the Bible that most of us as Christians engage in to one extent or another, how does it shape how we actually relate to the real world? And specifically, how does it help us to confront social injustice, tragedy, suffering? These are things that I'm not sure all biblical readers have a great reputation for engaging. I think we have to just recognize that sometimes the Bible and the way it's used can be an obstacle rather than a resource. But honestly, I've just found it so moving to see that lectern in the Village Center. We have this treasure, right? It's interesting. The person standing there could be preaching or could be reading from the Bible. Is there really a difference? How are these two things related? I mean, those are questions worth asking. But I love being in a place where we can just say that. We have this treasure, and yeah, it's been used in really bad ways, but it doesn't have to be, right? So that's what we're going to be thinking about this week. So as I said, we will be spending some time talking about Luther and the Reformation. We'll talk about wonderful gifts that Luther introduced. We'll also, as I said, talk about some doors that Luther may have closed. But we're going to try to surround Luther with a number of other very brief readings that, like paragraphs that we'll read together in class, and also some works of art. So on the left, you'll see Gregory of Nyssa, who was a Greek, he lived in Turkey, but wrote in Greek in the 4th century, and Augustine in the 5th century, very famous figures. We'll be looking at Gregory of Nyssa's writings on the book of Exodus, and he gives a really profound and provocative, contemplative, and allegorical reading of the book of Exodus. And then we'll look at some very short excerpts from Augustine's On Christian Teaching, which really, maybe the title wouldn't lead you to believe this, but really is sort of a manual of biblical reading. How do we read the Bible? And again, I think with both of these, we're going to see, wow, what they're saying is probably not what at least someone who's never really thought about it before would expect someone 1600 years ago to say about the Bible, because they are definitely not promoting anything resembling fundamentalism, anything resembling biblical literalism. They're also not promoting historical criticism or sort of academic ways of reading the Bible. They're promoting something very different that I think has been somewhat lost among Christians today. Then we're going to look at some very contemporary voices. Has anyone in here read this book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree by James Cone, before? Good. So at least one person has. This, for me, this is one of the best books of theology written in the last 30 or 40 years by James Cone, known as the founder of Black theology. He taught at Union Theological Seminary in New York City for decades, and he just died this May. I didn't know when I chose this book that he would die, but he had an obituary in the New York Times, and he kind of crossed over from academic theology into wider culture. But this book, I will say, for me personally, has been very formative, and it is accessible for people who aren't trained theologians. So it's something I would encourage you to read on your own. We will also be, in every class, we're going to listen to one or two excerpts from this concert-length choral work called Considering Matthew Shepard by Craig Hella Johnson, who's the director of a group based in Texas called Conspirare. I'll say more about that later. Has anyone encountered this work before? Good. Yeah. Well, I'll be interested to talk with you about it. I'll say more about that in a little while. We'll also, this is the Good Samaritan window from Chartres Cathedral in France. One of the things we'll look at later in the week is the way in which it's giving an allegorical interpretation of the Good Samaritan story. And by allegorical there, I don't mean like trying to figure out what the parable means, what it's a metaphor. I mean, it interprets it as being about something that would not really occur to any of us, right? So we'll talk about that later in the week, and we'll think both about the resources that offers and also why Martin Luther reacted against that sort of allegorical interpretation. All right, so I have on this screen here some possible metaphors for what the Bible is. And most of these I did not just invent. Most of these I could tell you the theologian I was thinking of or the person I drew this from. But these are very different ways of thinking about what the Bible is. And just to get us going this morning, I thought I have basically a handout here with these same metaphors on them. And I was thinking you could look at them for just a minute by yourself. And then I have a couple of discussion questions at the bottom. And if you could turn to someone, I like to do this in class, turn to someone whose name you don't know. If you know everybody's name, it's not a big deal, but it's a good way to get to know people you don't know and discuss these questions. We won't do this for very long, but this is just a way to start thinking about the advantages and disadvantages of these various metaphors. Okay, so let's just take maybe 20 more seconds to look at them ourselves. And as you're thinking about, you know, whether you could think of a better metaphor yourself, Pastor Becky in her sermon last night suggested one that I thought was interesting that we could talk about. All right, so if you could find someone whose name you don't know and just talk about these three questions that I put with the bullet points at the bottom, we'll do this for just like 5 minutes or so. All right, why don't we talk more together now? Who wants to share just first, which ones do you think are most commonplace among the Christians that you know in your life or among Christians that you see in popular culture or in the media? Which ones are most prevalent? Let's start with those.
It depends on what the Christian tradition is.
Mm, yeah.
Because some, like for example, number three.
A textbook of true doctrine?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Would be applicable to some Christian traditions or groups, but not to others.
Certainly. Yet, I will say conservative Lutherans, right? Especially those who say they're confessional, right? I must admit, I grew up in one of those traditions, right? Yeah. That's sort of the way I was told to read the Bible, right?
Yeah.
So that's good. Other ones you found common?
I think the textbook of true doctrine also goes along with more fundamental literal interpretation. Mm-hmm. Which maybe gets more media attention, mm-hmm. so that the overall culture may see that is what Christianity is about. Whereas
right.
the more progressive interpretation and metaphor mm-hmm. Does not get the same attention.
So what would be a more progressive metaphor among these?
I would say a love letter from God to every Christian, emphasizing the word every,
mm-hmm.
which means inclusiveness and that every person is a person loved by God and should be treated in ways that show that, which is a goal, but certainly far from attaining.
Right. That's one I took actually from Kierkegaard. That's his favorite metaphor. And the way he develops that is he says, imagine that you were in love with someone and they moved to a foreign country and somehow you hadn't heard from them in years. And somehow the only way you heard back from them was they wrote you a letter in a foreign language. And what he says is, and they were probably asking you to do something. Maybe, I don't know, maybe come meet me here in this place or something. And he says, well, you would have to start by translating it. You would have to start by figuring out what it means. But if you spent all your time just trying to like nail down the precise meaning of every word and you never actually did what they wanted you to do, you would really be culpable. So if God is telling us in the Bible, love everyone, if God is telling us in the Bible, seek justice, right? And that's basically the fundamental message. There's a problem with getting distracted with the wrong things. Good. Other thoughts? Either about ones you like or ones you don't like? Don?
Well, I think number four has kind of a dual thing for me. Is one, it can be looked at as it's just a narrative of what happened and it doesn't affect me at all. I just read it and that has, and then the other side is it's an archive of how it affected people during those times and how does that affect me? So it's
Right.
You know, it doesn't affect me, and it does affect me. It's been on.
Yeah, did anybody else think about that word archive? I mean, this is one, I think it's almost not a metaphor. It's almost just a literal description of what the Bible is, right? It's this collation of texts written over more than 1,000 years, some of which even the individual texts have multiple authors, coming from many different points of view. This is something when I, you know, my specialty is not really the Bible, but I do teach courses on the Bible at TLU. And one of the things I always try to, show to the students is how much the authors of the Bible are arguing with one another, right? They are not presenting just this unified system of ideas. They have different theologies, right? And we don't have one narrative of Jesus's life. We have four, and they're really different. If you read the Gospel of Mark alongside the Gospel of John, they're telling two very different stories with really different theologies of who Jesus is. And I do an exercise with students where we look at the crucifixion narrative and everything from, was Jesus crucified on the first day of Passover or on the second day of Passover? In Mark, he's crucified the first day of Passover because, the second day of Passover because Mark has him celebrate a Passover Seder with his disciples the night before, and that's where we get Holy Communion from. John has him crucified I say the first day of Passover, it's really the day of preparation for Passover because the Jewish day started at sundown, right? But what would you do on the day of the day of preparation for the Passover in this Jewish context? You would sacrifice a Passover lamb, right? And John, in a very allegorical way, is trying to tell us Jesus is the Passover lamb, right? And so John never tells us the story of the Last Supper, right? That he knows it in like John 6, there's all this stuff about I'm the bread of life, whoever eats my flesh will have eternal life. So he's referencing it, but I think because he kind of knows the synoptic gospels already, he doesn't really need to tell that story, right? So he can go to a different meaning, right? There are many, many places throughout the Bible where the different authors are presenting contesting points of view. And there was actually an effort in the second century. There's this text in Greek called the Dia Tesseron, which means like from four into one. Dia meaning from and Tesseron meaning four. And this is an effort to synthesize all the gospel narratives into one coherent narrative. That text still exists, but that did not become the Bible. So it's really interesting to me that we've chosen to value this diversity of voices. Like even if you went to the Holden Library or the Holden Archives, I don't know where that is, they're probably not all saying the same thing. Right? And there might be things in there that if we went back to a sermon that was being preached in 1968, that we might say, you know, that's really not helpful anymore. I could see what it meant in that time, but being Christians in this place means something different now. So I too think using this word archive or library can be helpful. Were there any others that spoke to you? Yeah.
Well, there are several, it seems to me, as we talked about it as well, that you could take the Christians out, take Christian out and say spiritual seeker or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
Like the number 9, maybe even number 8, seven, number 6.
Yeah.
Could, and maybe even 5, could be someone who's just spiritual but not religious.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, I worry sometimes that Christians have done a good job of alienating such people and convincing them that the Bible is not for them. But I agree with you that it can be a resource. And also, I mean, I wrote the word Christians there because I sort of assumed we were in a Christian community, but let's not forget what Christians call the Old Testament is also the Jewish Tanakh. Muslims read the entire Christian Bible as holy literature, even if it's not on a par with the Quran. So yeah, it's not just Christians' book, that's for sure. Any others that spoke to you? Yeah, in the back.
You mentioned number 9. For those of us who are into liturgy and make use of the liturgical 3-year, the series of scripts for prayer when we, a service that's centered around a psalm, we do a psalm saying each time.
Yep.
It's definitely a script for prayer and contemplation.
Yeah, I agree. And in some cases, again, this is almost not a metaphor. I was thinking of this last night when Pastor Marcus said, well, and we're going to sing a psalm, and that's in the middle part of our ELW, and we're just basically taking song right out of the Bible and singing it ourselves, right? We're performing this sort of script that's already there. So that's a really direct example of it. I don't know that we'll necessarily look at good examples of this week, but when we think of ancient and medieval biblical interpretation, so much of the Bible functioned this way. Even, we will talk about Gregory's meditation on the life of Moses, for example. And what he's doing there is he's saying, all right, we have this kind of weird story of Moses in the book of Exodus, who's born, and then he's placed into the river for Pharaoh's daughter to find, and there's some weird narratives in there of death and slaughter and God killing all of the Egyptian babies. We're going to see that really bothers Gregory, that God would do that. But he is constantly saying, don't just read this as something that happened. If it was just that, it would just be one more story out there, one more historical record that may or may not be true. But what's valuable is that it is a metaphor for Moses ascending Mount Sinai and receiving the law from God. And for him, that's a symbol of the life of virtue, right? So we'll talk about this, I guess, tomorrow. But he's going to say, this isn't just Moses' story. This can be your story as well. You can read this prayerfully so that it shows you how to climb this mountain of virtue in your own life. And you're going to have to figure out in your own life what it means to follow God's law. And just reading the Ten Commandments or the 613 commandments of the Torah, that's not going to do it. You've got to actually meditate on it. You've got to kind of follow these scripts for prayer and contemplation. Another great example of this is the Song of Songs, right? That it's a book that never mentions God. It's one of two books in the Bible that never gives the name God. Clearly, on the literal level, I mean, I think it's clear to most of us, this is basically erotic poetry, right? About love between a man and a woman in this case. And yet, for centuries, Christians have read this as a kind of metaphor for God's love for the world, for the relationship between the church and God and the individual Christian and God, or the relationship between Israel and God. You read some of these monks in the Middle Ages, like Bernard of Clairvaux, and they want God to be male. They sort of assume that. So that means Bernard has to put himself in the place of the woman in the Song of Songs. And there's some pretty racy stuff in there. But he embodies that perspective and says the thing that the woman says to her lover as prayers to God, as a way of sort of strengthening his faith and strengthening his desire for God. So that's another good example. Did anyone have any other metaphors that you suggested? Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking of people right now in this cultural time in the Western world are so focused on goals and where they're going to go, and they have a Fitbit thing going on and whatever. So would a current metaphor be something like a challenge or a call for action? That the Cronus idea of time, of urgent time, what's needed right now, despite there's all the archive and all the historical part, but a metaphor of Here's what needs to happen now.
Right. And maybe that kind of goes back to the point I said Kierkegaard was trying to make. Like, there's a lot that's really complicated in the Bible, and there's probably a lot that doesn't apply directly to us anymore. But there are some pretty core themes that appear again and again and again, like love your neighbor as yourself, care for the poor, seek justice for the oppressed. And those things really aren't that hard to figure out. They are very hard to accomplish. They are very hard to do day by day. If we think about those as these sort of fundamental Christian objectives, I think that's helpful.
It's certainly a map.
Yeah, as Pastor Becky said. Yeah, when we find ourselves in these difficult situations, when we face conflict, it provides a map with which to orient ourselves. Like, where do I find God in this situation? It can provide a map for that. Yeah.
Number six. I mean, like a sacred space for Christians to meditate and grow.
Yeah.
Studying the Bible, reading books about the Bible, and just being able to make it fit what's happening in your own life.
Yeah, good. And that one and the one, a museum Christians should visit regularly, I took from Dale Martin, whose book I put at the bottom of your sheet. If you're interested in these questions about how we think about the Bible and also how the Bible is taught in colleges and seminaries, I would recommend this book. This is a book that's been very influential for me. But he proposes a lot of different metaphors in that book. But the ones I like best are, he says, maybe we should think of the Bible less as a rule book or an instruction book or a book of doctrine, and more like a cathedral we enter, where we can go and sit and look at pictures and pray and say these scripts that draw us closer to God. Maybe it's more like a space we enter, which also kind of sounds similar to that map metaphor as well, than it is a book that gives us specific doctrines to believe or rules to follow. I mean, when I asked my TLU students sometimes on the first day of class similar questions, they all tell me, they all learn in Sunday school that the Bible stands for basic instructions before leaving Earth, right? So I've heard that so many times, and I'm so sick of it. But yeah. Did anybody else have another metaphor themselves? Yeah, please.
New Testament to me is Jesus, God, he understood the basic message of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what it is. And you need to not just read it, you need to do it. And it may be hazardous to your health physically, but spiritually you need to do it.
Yeah. And it's also interesting to think about how Jesus relates to what is the Bible for him, right? What we would call the Old Testament. Because on the one hand, he quotes it all the time, right? Like in Luke, especially one of his first public teachings is when he quotes, God has anointed me to bring deliverance to the captives and justice to the oppressed. And he's constantly quoting the prophets. But there are other times where he literally disobeys the Bible. I mean, the Bible says not to work on the Sabbath, and he does, right? This is kind of a complicated example, but when he's asked about divorce, his Bible gives a really clear example to that, and that is a man can divorce a woman whenever he wants to, right? And the woman has no similar rights. I mean, that's straight out of Exodus and Deuteronomy and similar places. And yet Jesus doesn't go there. Right? He gives this kind of creative reading where he goes back to the book of Genesis and talks about Adam and Eve being made for each other and being made to live in communion. Now, his teaching about divorce can have some dangerous consequences when we read it today, because he basically says no divorce. However, if you read it in like its historical context, I think he's really kind of standing up for the woman in these situations who has no rights, is being treated as property, and can be divorced at any time for any reason as long as the husband writes a certificate of divorce. And Jesus pushes back against what the Bible says in the name of this larger principle of love. Now, the danger is sometimes we then cling to what he said in, 2,000 years ago, and we use that in unloving ways today, right? But I think all of this is a good example of how the Bible can be used in really hurtful ways and in really loving ways. And I think for those of us who kind of claim this as our scripture, as our archive, as our book, it's our job to work to read it in ways that build up love. And so that's one of the things we'll be talking about throughout the week. So we have about 25 minutes left here, and I wanted to basically spend the rest of our time introducing this piece of music that is going to accompany us throughout the week. This is the CD cover here. This is a piece of music, I must say, that I truly love. I'm not saying it's always easy. It's, as we'll talk about, it's obviously narrating or meditating upon a really tragic and traumatic event. But it is so beautiful and so theologically powerful. I was thinking, as I was getting ready for this class, that in the last couple of years, there are sort of two engrossing, lengthy pieces of music that I've just been obsessed with. One is the Hamilton soundtrack, and the other is this. And this one I could actually see in concert. Hamilton I can't afford and haven't had the opportunity to see. But Craig Hella Johnson, so someone said, I saw a hand, someone said that they had heard this piece of music. Yeah. I'll be interested. You might have special insight as we go on. Just a little bit about Craig Hella Johnson. He lives in Austin. He used to be the choral director for UT Austin. Was that for many years. His father was a Lutheran pastor. He's a graduate of St. Olaf College, like me, which makes me like him. But I would say, I mean, I don't really know where he is religiously. I've never met him personally. I've seen them perform several times. But there is such theological wisdom in this piece of music, I think. Just a quick review. I think most of us know this story already. I was wondering if there were going to be people younger than me here who might not have direct memories of when this happened. But this happened when I was in high school. I have really clear memories of this. And just to review, Matthew Shepard was a college student in Wyoming and was killed by two men in a homophobic hate crime, and was really mercilessly beaten and chained to this fence and left to die in the wilderness. There were horrible protests after this event. I mean, homophobic people protesting this man's funeral. But it also became a kind of cause, a thing that was focused on throughout popular culture for resisting hate, for becoming more welcoming to LGBT people. And today, there are a number of hate crime laws that are named after Matthew Shepard. I think the most recent one was passed in 2009. So there are a number of laws called Matthew Shepard Acts, which make crimes committed out of hate against certain classes of people into a different sort of crime. So the two young men who perpetrated this crime are now serving, they each have been given multiple life sentences for what they did. So it's, you might think, well, what does this have to do with reading the Bible? Why are we going to, at every class that I lead this week, why are we going to listen to at least one and sometimes two of these songs? We won't be able to listen to the whole thing. It's about 2 hours long. I was thinking to myself, well, even if I do a terrible job with this class, at least you guys will get to hear this music because it is really great. And you can, like, I have the CD because I wanted the liner notes, but you can, it's on Spotify and all of the online services. It's not hard to find. In any event, what does this have to do with the Bible? Well, I think one answer to that is, if at least for Christians and frankly, especially for Lutherans, one of the centers of the Bible is the story of the cross, is the story of Jesus being killed in what is sort of the ultimate injustice, the ultimate tragedy. There's a kind of parallel there, right? Like, what are Christians doing meditating over and over and over again on this symbol and this story of injustice, of oppression, of Roman brutality, Roman power, the strong triumphing over the weak, right? There's a parallel to the story of Matthew Shepard there. And I think it, even at the time, it didn't take a lot of theological creativity to see it because the imagery of his being chained to the fence was so crucological, right? It was so cross-like. And that's something that Craig Hella Johnson does a really good job of picking up on. Also, I don't think he goes overboard with pursuing the connection. I think one of the things we'll see that he really emphasizes is Matthew Shepard was an ordinary boy, right? He was not, you know, he wasn't God. He wasn't, he was just an ordinary boy trying to live an ordinary life. So that's going to be a theme we see throughout. And yet, for those of us who have an imagination shaped by the Bible, I don't see how we cannot see this story in Christological terms. And one of the really interesting ways in which Craig Hella Johnson kind of invokes that in the music is that there are certain moments when he will use motifs from Bach Passions in the music. We'll listen to this later in the week, but some of you may know these pieces of music better than I do. I don't know if this is the St. John Passion or the St. Matthew Passion, but there's a piece about the funeral where the members of the Westboro Baptist Church are protesting, and they will be singing in very Bach-like music, Kreuzige, Kreuzige, which means crucify, crucify, and that's a piece directly out of the Bach Passions. One other way in which I think this can help us think about the Bible is Craig Hella Johnson and Conspirare are known for sort of melding very diverse musical forms. So some of it is very classical sounding. There are also cowboy songs in this. There are kind of pop songs. There's folk songs. This is kind of Craig Keller Johnson's signature. And, you know, in Texas, there he does a Christmas concert every year where he has this sort of signature style he calls collage, where he'll, you know, there'll be O Come Emmanuel, and then he'll somehow fuse it with a piece by like Dolly Parton or something. It sounds crazy on the surface, and yet he's so brilliant, it really does work. So I think there's a way in which that is sort of like the Bible, right? I mean, the diversity of voices and styles and genres that we have in the Bible, I think this piece kind of mirrors that. And then finally, I would say that, if we're talking, one of the things that I think, Martin Luther may have closed the door on is this more contemplative approach to reading the Bible. I think we'll see. Luther is a complex figure. There's gifts and there are obstacles in Luther, and we're going to face both. But often Luther looks to the Bible for a source of certainty, right? He's kind of foreclosed every other source of certainty. No longer does the church provide authority. No longer does the Pope provide authority. No longer does tradition provide authority. His one authority for doctrine is the Bible, right? And in that context, it sort of makes sense, but it has maybe inculcated in subsequent Christians this idea that the Bible is a book of answers, that the Bible tells us the truth about whatever question we have for it. And I don't think this piece ever really does that, right? But it just sort of asks us to look at this tragedy, look at it from all different sides. I've heard Craig Keller Johnson talk about this, and he said that he had thought about for a while calling this the Passion of Matthew Shepard, which would have really amped up the Christological dimension. But he said that for him what was most powerful was just kind of, he said he'd sort of been working on this for like a decade at least, and this is the 20th anniversary of Matthew Shepard's killing in 2018, is... he said what he was really doing was just kind of sitting with it, contemplating it, trying to see it from the side of Matthew Shepard's parents, trying to see it from the side of his killers, trying to see it from the side of the tens of thousands of people who went on pilgrimages to the fence to be in that place in the months following this death. So I think that if we're looking for a more contemplative way of reading the Bible, of kind of relating to the Bible like we sometimes relate to art, I think this piece can kind of lead us towards that. Certainly an idea I've been playing with. I hope it proves to do that for us. If it doesn't, at least it's a good piece of music. There's no doubt about that, at least in my mind. But I think we will see analogies and parallels to the more traditional theology we'll be looking at throughout this week. So why don't we... today we're going to listen to two pieces, and the first one is, it's actually the very first track on the CD. I'm going to start it a little ways in, and as you listen, I just encourage you to listen in sort of a contemplative way. Listen for words or images or phrases that strike you, and if you have a better, more refined musical vocabulary than I do, feel free to talk more about the music. And then beyond that, just think about the sort of attitude or disposition that it is cultivating in you. So as I say, this is from very early in the piece. It's very focused on the place of Wyoming. I think Holden is one of these places that the identity of the people here is so tied to nature. I think this really conveys that this was true for Matthew Shepard as well. And I have texts for all of the music I'm going to play this week, so I'll pass those out as this is playing. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. So we're going to stop there. One thing I wanted to mention is this name of this group, Conspirare. If you know Latin, you know it means to breathe together. So I've always thought, what a wonderful name for a choir. And when they begin a concert, at least the Christmas concert, they almost always have everyone in this entire auditorium take a breath together, and you can hear 1,000 people breathing together. Were there images or themes or aspects of this song that caught your attention? For any reason, it doesn't have to be related to the Bible.
I heard the pounding of the cross immediately.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And you thought of that, you said, as the cross?
Yeah, right away.
Wow. That is really interesting.
Yeah,
good. That's really good. Other things you, yeah.
Biblical in terms of what days. I just heard the Brahms Requiem a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that the Brahms Requiem is really this text, well, it's the biblical text, is everything fades. What is beautiful fades.
Yeah, like Ecclesiastes.
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
So the horses, cattle, sky, and grass, those things that sway and pass.
Mm-hmm.
Pass. Well, maybe with a double meaning.
Absolutely. Yeah, and the things that we are so in love with right now, but we also have to realize that they sway and pass. Yeah. Other things? Yeah.
I read the quick glob of horses.
Yeah, yeah.
Made me think of our journey. We're all passing along.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are a lot of themes throughout this work of pilgrimage and life as a journey. Good. Yeah.
The sound was just heaven. Mm-hmm. It was like an angel choir, of course. And the text and the sound, sort of, to me, it felt like, and he died such a awful.
Right.
And this was such a way, the words that say he's joined, a human being can join himself.
Yeah.
Right? That it,
yeah.
There can be beauty in
mm-hmm.
this circle.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt, this to me felt comforting in a way, like, mm-hmm. hey, he's alive.
Right, right. Good. Yeah, please.
In a sense, the word that comes to mind, accompaniment,
mm-hmm.
that on that journey that there's an accompaniment, there's a something that has beauty that
right.
is the difficulty of the pilgrimage.
Yeah, and I think that is a real recurring theme throughout the work. One piece that we will not listen to this week, Gus is a real detail that the first person who discovered Matthew Shepard when he was unconscious reported that there was a doe who had been there with him all night long, like 20 feet away, just kneeling with him. I mean, it's just like, what do you even do with that, you know? But that's a really powerful piece in the song, in the larger work. Yeah.
I heard Circle of Life in the Lion King.
Uh-huh.
And then I heard Tis a Gift to be Simple, that
uh-huh.
lovely, lovely flowing melody. I heard that in the music.
Good, yeah. I especially that one, yeah, I kind of hear echoes of that too. Well, we have about 6 minutes left, so I'm going to play one more song. I think you guys are definitely picking up on at least what I find powerful in this work of music. This next one is two tracks later, and this is really introducing, this is right before the larger piece of music actually starts telling the story of Matthew Shepard, and it's sort of reflecting again on this question of why do we keep telling these stories of trauma and loss? I mean, you could ask the same thing about the cross. Why do we keep telling this story year after year? And I would think about, again, just things that jump out at you, but also what might the way this song is asking us to listen to this piece, what might it say about how we should approach the Bible?
Thank you.
Right, so we have about 30 seconds before our time is up. But any quick things that you just want to say jumped out at you?
That is so tender. We are so kind now to be wounded by what follows.
Right. And for me, this word open that is repeated again and again, and that's what the one part of the choir responds with, we are open to hear the story that we probably don't want to hear, right? That's so painful. I mean, that's contemplation, right? I mean, contemplation in Greek, it's kind of a visual metaphor in Greek. It's looking at something. But this whole tradition of contemplating the Bible, contemplation in prayer, it's basically about being open to these texts or these images or these pieces of music that are outside of us, and we're just going to consider them for a little while. What's interesting is one of the reasons Luther is so against contemplation is he thinks it's a work. It's like us trying to reach God rather than recognizing how God reaches us. But here it's just the opposite, right? It's about us just being open to what the story can say. All right, so next time we will read some passages from these ancient interpreters, Gregory of Nyssa and Augustine, and we'll play a couple more pieces from this piece of music. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.